Okay, so the second of our talks on the Bodhisattva ideal, and tonight, laying the foundations, generosity and ethics. So over these next three evenings, we're going to be looking at the six perfections, at the paramitas practiced by the Bodhisattva. And tonight we're going to look at the first two, dana, generosity, and sila, ethics. These are practices, but they're also qualities. In the traditional Indo-Tibetan iconography, bodhisattvas appear as beautiful 16-year-old princes and princesses. And as part of the symbolism, the paramitas appear as the exquisitely beautiful jewellery that they wear, made from precious metals and finest jewels. So we could say that the paramitas adorn the bodhisattvas, amplify their beauty. So let's not lose sight of this aspect of beauty, adornment. Even if quite a bit of the discussion of dana and of sila, of ethics, that follows is of necessity quite pragmatic and practical, still have this sense of them as qualities that adorn, make beautiful the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So to begin with, the paramita, the perfection of dana or generosity. And dana is said to be the fundamental Buddhist quality or virtue, the capacity to give, go out to another, to move away from self-interest and self-concern is essential if we're even going to place a first foot on the spiritual path. And we could also say the capacity to give, whether of possessions or of oneself, is probably quite a good indicator of spiritual progress. So giving, generosity, In that we see the beginning of a realignment of one's being away from narrow egotism and self-interest towards an open-hearted concern for the interests of others. A realignment of our being more in accord with the way things really are. So it's for a very good reason that dana, generosity, is the first of the paramitas, and it is a quality very much valued through the whole Buddhist tradition, very fully explored. And I'm going to use a number of those traditional categories in my exploration tonight, categories that Bhante himself also has used. I'm going to skate over some of the things he had to say and add a few comments and perspectives of my own. So first of all, to whom does one give? There's the old English saying, charity begins at home, and the first of the traditional categories of who one gives is family and friends, those in one's immediate environment. So we really do need to be kind and generous to those we live with, those we share our lives with. And it is all too easy to take people for granted. You know, parents, family, partners, fellow community dwellers, workmates. We can all too easily think of the spiritual life as happening over there somewhere rather than right here at home. So do you practice kindness, generosity to those closest to you? I mean, of course, sometimes it can be easier to practice generosity to those closest to us, you know, to give our family and partners expensive presents whilst we're rather grudging of giving to others. So, well, charity needs to start at home, but it certainly shouldn't stop there. So the second category, the second traditional category, is the poor, the sick, the needy, the helpless. And again, I think we can all too easily let ourselves off the hook. You know, I'm spiritual, I do the metta bhavana every day, I put money in the dana bowl at the centre. You know, when we actually think of the hunger, the sickness, the suffering in the world, we can all too easily just think of it as somebody else's problem. So, yeah, there is the question, is that good enough? You know, there is so much extreme suffering in the world whilst we live in really, quite a degree of comfort and luxury. So we can at least give some money from time to time for those working directly to alleviate hunger, sickness, poverty. You know, we do just take a very comfortable way of life for granted. And yeah, I think it's just worth asking, how restrained are we in our giving to those who are really living in poverty and sickness and so on? Just by wanting to maintain our small comforts. So then the third category is the full-timers in the spiritual life. The third category of those to whom one can give, should give. So in the traditional Buddhist world, this was the monks, those who were practicing full-time, more deeply, and also who were passing on the teachings of the Buddha down the generations, making sure that the Dharma remained available to others. So you could say for us, this means supporting our centres, supporting those working full time for the Dharma. You know, the world so much needs the Dharma. Are we doing all we can to help the work of spreading the Dharma, to help those working to spread the Dharma? We can actually live a life dedicated to the Dharma, or if we're living a more conventional life, well, we can give money to help spread the Dharma. You know, in some Christian and other groups, people give 10% of their income, you know, a tithe, to actually help spread the word. So again, you know, we need to just really look at our generosity. And just exploring it as we are doing on a retreat like this just gives us an opportunity to really question, how generous are we? How circumscribed is our generosity? Just look quite honestly at ourselves, you know, not in a self-righteous way or in a self-flagellating way, but just really honestly looking at how generous we are and where those invisible barriers are that we put up that limit our generosity. Another category of those to whom we can give are the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We can make offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. An interesting one, I think, for many of us. Now, there's that story of Anathapindika, the banker, disciple of the Buddha, who very soon after he became the Buddha's disciple wanted to buy a park near his home city of Sarvati for the Buddha and his disciples. And there was this beautiful park owned by Prince Jetta, and Prince Jetta didn't want to sell it, but Anathapindika wanted it for the Buddha. He wanted to give, and even though the price asked by Prince Jetta was ridiculous, as soon as he named a price, you know, a cart full of gold or whatever it was, he said, it's sold, and he held him to his word. So he just, he couldn't give enough. He couldn't express his gratitude deeply enough to the Buddha. His faith, his devotion, his gratitude were just expressed in his giving to the Buddha. And our offerings to the Buddha may often consist of sticks of incense, and we may even sort of, you know, have little sort of thoughts going on in our mind, well, it's only going to go up in smoke, you know, what's the point of giving to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas if it's just sort of going up in smoke, you know, and it's £3 for a packet, you know, cup of coffee for that, you know, sort of how much do those sort of thoughts go on in our minds? And maybe even more so. You know, we've had people questioning, well, ought we to be spending at Padmaloka £10,000 a year on these paintings? you know, to beautify our shrine room, to actually create a beautiful place, you know, aren't the more obvious and pressing needs, you know, for money to be spent. So it's an interesting question, you know, again, maybe one to really explore, you know, just the idea of actually spending money on beautiful shrine rooms, creating environments that are uplifting, you know, and where do you draw the line, you know? We see these golden plated spires in Thailand and people living in poverty, you know. Where do we draw the line, you know, where do we find a measure for our generosity, if you like, our giving to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas? An interesting way of looking at it, well, the whole question of giving is that everything we give to whoever we give, whatever we give, is an offering to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You know, whatever, whether it's giving a talk, whether it's some money in the Dana bowl, whether it's money to a beggar, a present to a friend, it's all. We can have that sense that all our giving is an offering to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's an interesting way of looking at it that sort of, again, undercuts a lot of our usual ways of thinking. And if we really think about it, it's actually rather challenging. Okay, let's go on to the second category for looking at dana and generosity. What can be given? So in principle, whatever can be owned can also be given. Everything and anything can be given. Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara begins with worship and offerings, and he gives the whole universe. You know, nothing is too little to give to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, at least in his imagination. But then, bringing it back down to practicalities, well, the traditional list, material things, including money, time, energy. One of the things that it said traditionally we can give is fearlessness. You know, there's that figure of Amoghasiddhi, the green Buddha of the north, who has the Abhaya Mudra, the mudra of fearlessness. And there is just so much anxiety and fear in the world. And you know, through contacting our deeper faith, confidence, trust in the Dharma, and hence faith, trust, confidence in life, we can actually communicate something of stability, confidence to others through our own deepening faith, kindness, consistency. Not to be underestimated. Another thing that is said we can give is education and culture. In the Wheel of Life, we have the Blue Buddha in the animal realm holding a book, giving the gift of culture to those in the animal realm, making possible a truly human existence, which is needed as the foundation for a spiritual life, a higher life. Again, I think there's a lot in that that you know, you might want to think about and explore. You know, what does it really mean to give education? What does it really mean to give culture? What does it mean to actually create the possibility for others of a truly human life, which is the necessity, a necessary foundation for a truly spiritual life or higher life? Another category that we're said to be able to give, that the Bodhisattva can give, or the practicing Buddhist can give, is life and limb. You know, one's even can be even prepared to give one's life for others, though of course not foolishly, not lightly. And then merit, giving away of merit. You know, we give away our merit every time we do the puja, the transference of merit and self-surrender. And again, I think this is quite an interesting thing to think about. So merit is obviously, it's not stamps and tokens or cash in the bank. I had a friend who used to talk of merit stamps. harking back to the days of these green shield stamps, you know. You used to get these stamps every time you went to the supermarket and put them in books. Well, he talked of collecting his merit stamps and cashing them in now and again. So perhaps the most useful way of understanding merit is in terms of the positive momentum of our spiritual efforts, so that when we transfer our merits and surrender ourselves, we're actually making sure that whatever benefits we gain through our practices, they're dedicated to the welfare and benefit of others. We're using the fruits of our practice to go deeper and to benefit others. I think maybe Pabhavajra mentioned last night, it's not unusual for people come to a centre, maybe in a bit of a mess, practice for a while, you know, even quite enthusiastically and sincerely, become much more positive, happy, healthy human beings. As a result of that, become that bit more attractive, and other people start to find them attractive, particularly a particular person. And what do? They cash in their merit stamps. You know, they actually use the fruits of all their spiritual practice to settle themselves down. And sometimes they just disappear. It's almost like, you know, they've gone so far and they've cashed in their merit, rather than just using that momentum, building on that momentum, as it were, to build a stronger and stronger momentum in their spiritual life. Because it is said, the more you give away your merit, the more you get back. There's quite a nice little image that an older member called Ratnaketu once came up with, where he talked about how we all have this rusty iron ball, really sort of heavy, rather ugly, heavy iron ball, but we're holding it quite tightly because it's ours, it's mine, and you're not going to have it. But then one day, somehow, the sun is shining, we're feeling a bit more expansive, we throw it to somebody else, and it comes back to us, and it's a little bit lighter and a bit shinier, and we throw it away again, and it comes back again a little bit lighter, and soon, you know, we're just sort of joyfully playing with this shimmering ball of sort of light and jewels, that the more we give away, the more it comes back. You know, this is the whole image of the transference of merit. So what we have to be careful is that at some point we don't just sort of get hold of this beautiful ball of light and think, God, this is mine. You know, I'm not letting him have his dirty hands on it. You know, so we start holding on to it. But then, you know, the longer we hold on to it, the more the jewels all start to fall off. The light turns solid and we end up holding again this rusty iron ball. So we do need to have this whole attitude of constantly giving away the benefits of our practice, if you like. Not holding on to them, not, as it were, using them to reinforce our sense of self, but using them to make us more able to go out and help others. And then the greatest gift is said to be the gift of the Dharma, the source of the deepest peace, happiness and meaning for anybody. And yeah, it is just so important that we're making the Dharma available to our suffering world. And you know, this is the whole point, if you like, of the Bodhisattva ideal. This is the whole point of our order, you know, a place where we can both practice together and have an effect on the world, actually give to the world at the same time as transforming ourselves. So then, how to give? Moving on to another category. How to give? Well, courteously, politely, with a smile. You're not throwing money at a beggar, not grudgingly, not awkwardly, but yeah, happily, readily, and without regret. You know, it's all too easy to give and then, when it's gone, start making all sorts of calculations, Was it the right thing? All sorts of thoughts going on in our mind, which just then clouds the act of giving. And we need to actually give without regret. It's gone, forget it. And then without talking about it. So, well, probably none of us are going to be going in for sort of plaques and names, you know. But we do have to watch, I think, about talking to ourselves, you know. We may not even talk to others, but we may talk to ourselves about how good we are, how generous we are, start comparing ourselves with others. So, and yeah, just watching out for pride, smugness, any self-righteousness there in our giving. So then, to friend and foe alike, not picking and choosing, you know, not wheeling and dealing. It's a real test of our metta-bhavana, I think. You know, it's fine to sit there and give the love and friendship equally to our good friend and to the neutral person and the enemy, but when it comes to giving, you know, whether it's time or friendship or whatever, how do we measure up, you know, in terms of who we're prepared to give to? And then everywhere, at all times. So generosity becomes not just a practice, but actually an expression of a generous, open-hearted attitude of kindness, of being, a whole attitude, a whole orientation. And then finally, observing due proportion. So in there as well, in the Bodhisattva's giving, needs to be a certain wisdom, a certain sense of proportion and appropriateness. But not one that's sort of painfully calculated, but one that has a naturalness and an ease, you know, rather than a calculated awkwardness. So just moving to another list of ways of giving that we find in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha speaks of eight ways of giving. So spontaneously, you know, just if you like, we've got a positive habit of generosity of heart, a readiness to give. Then he says we can give out of fear, or we can give just in order to protect ourselves or to because we're afraid we're going to be looked at in a bad light if we don't give, or whatever. Or because of thinking he too has given me a gift. Or because of thinking he will give me a present too. So, you know, we can actually give in a way out of, with a calculating attitude. Or because of thinking I cook, but they, being ascetics, do not. Since I cook, it would not be proper for me to refuse giving a meal to those who do not cook. So this refers back to ancient India, where the wandering sadhus, the wandering shramanas, didn't cook their food. They only took the food of the householder. So it's almost like a convention, a conventional attitude. Well, it's the done thing, so I should give. So we can give just out of convention. Or by giving such a gift, I shall earn a good reputation. And then finally, one gives because it ennobles the mind, adorns the mind. And I'd like to come back to this last one, because there's another similar list we're going to look at in a moment that ends with the same one. Because one gives because it ennobles the mind, adorns the mind. So now on to why. Why to give? Well, we can say we give to overcome greed, craving, grasping, attachment. We give in order to attain the freedom of enlightenment. We give to benefit all beings. And there's another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, which gives another eight reasons for giving. So, out of affection, So just out of liking somebody or warmth towards them. Or in an angry mood. You know, one gives away a computer because it's playing up. Or you just give somebody something just to get rid of them. Out of stupidity. So, yeah, let's not forget that's a possibility. We can give out of stupidity. Out of fear. Out of fear of divine retribution or superstition or whatever. Or because of thinking, such gifts have been given by my father and grandfather, and it was done by them before, hence it would be unworthy of me to give up this old family tradition. So again, one gives out of, if you like, social compunction or habit. Or because of thinking, if by giving this gift, I shall be reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world after death. So, you know, because we think giving's a good thing to do and it's going to give us good karma, you know, it's going to give us a good rebirth. That would certainly be quite a strong idea in the traditional Buddhist world, you know, that by giving to the monks particularly, one might have a very good rebirth. Or because of thinking, when giving this gift, my heart will be glad and happiness and joy will arise in me. That sounds fair enough, doesn't it? But then again, it's me, you know, I'm giving in order to be happy and glad and joyful. Which is fair enough, but it's still, you know, we're giving to feel good rather than for the benefit of others. Or one gives because it ennobles and adorns the mind. And so the Buddha ended both of these slightly different lists. You know, he must have just been giving different teachings on different days with this same final way of giving or reason for giving. One gives because it ennobles and adorns the mind. So I think here we're moving from dana as a mundane paramita to be practiced as part of the work of transformation. We're moving towards this spontaneous giving that's a natural expression of transcendental perfection, where one just gives because it's a beautiful thing to do, because there's a beauty to it and an expansiveness to it that takes us beyond ourselves, that points towards another way of being. So as a mundane practice of dana, we can speak of renunciation, of giving up, of letting go, in order to move beyond craving and attachment. So we can also see giving, you know, one side of giving as a practice that's to do with, you know, there's a giving away, there's also a giving up, a letting go, in order to move beyond craving and attachment. And again, in time, this flows into the transcendental expression of the heart, mind of the Bodhisattva, where there's no distinction between the giver, the gift, and one given to. Just this spontaneous flow of energy of that takes things to where they're most needed, most helpful. So, just looking at this consideration of dana, of generosity, with a brief look at the four sangrahavastus, the four means of unification, by which the Bodhisattva builds the Buddha land, creates the Buddha field, creates a spiritual community. And the first of these four sangrahavastus, or means of unification, is dana, is generosity. And here it's very clearly not just a means of personal transformation. Dana here becomes a way of bringing people together on the basis of the Dharma, creating a field of open-hearted generosity through which metta, through which the Dharma can flow and flourish. Bhante has said in one of his talks, amongst the spiritual community, that it would be natural for there to be a constant flow of gifts and giving. And we could say that it's going to be a good measure of the health of a Sangha, the extent to which it's pervaded by generosity and a generous reaching out into the world. Okay, so dana, generosity, the paramita of giving. So moving on now to the perfection, the paramita of sila, or ethics. So there's not time to go into all the precepts in detail, and we do that very fully on our 10 pillars going for refuge retreat, where we look at Bhante's discussion of the 10 precepts that we take at ordination. So what I'm going to do is just make a few more general points about the 10 precepts. So the 10 precepts have a negative formulation. So, for example, I undertake the training precept not to take life. And they have a positive formulation. With deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. So it is very important that we really do take on board the understanding that certain actions cause suffering and harm and are to be avoided. So we don't, for example, eat meat, and we don't encourage abortion, just to state two very obvious examples. But also very significant here, Bhante, Sangharakshita, often in ordination ceremonies and in his teachings over the years, again and again has pointed out that the real spirit of the precepts lies not in the prohibitions, not in the listing of unskillful actions that we undertake to avoid. Above all, the real meaning, the real significance of the precept lies in the cultivation of the skillful, in the cultivation of kindness and love, generosity, stillness, simplicity and contentment, truthful, kind, meaningful, harmonizing speech, in the cultivation of a mind that is tranquil, compassionate and truly wise, seeing into the deepest nature of things. And I think this is something to really reflect on, that what we're really about in practicing the precept isn't just avoiding harming and killing, it's developing real love and kindness. It's not just avoiding craving and grasping, but developing really, truly open-handed generosity. In his discussion of the 10 precepts in the 10 pillars, Bhante places great emphasis on the first precept. He speaks of the golden rule, do unto others as you would they would do unto you. He quotes the Dharmapada. All living beings are terrified of punishment. All fear death. Making comparison of others with oneself, one should neither kill nor cause to kill. All living beings are terrified of punishment. To all, life is dear. Making comparison of others with oneself, one should neither kill nor cause to kill. But then he goes on to quote Shelley, the English poet. The great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature, and our identification of ourselves with the beautiful, which exists in thought, action, or person, not our own. A man to be greatly good must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. And all the other precepts are seen as an ever fuller, deeper working out of the implications of this first precept. On the Buddha's last tour, shortly before his parinirvana, his death, as documented very beautifully in the Mahaparinirvana Sutta of the Pali Canon, we see him on his last tour, again and again, seeking to encourage, arouse, and inspire his disciples. And he teaches them the progressive path to enlightenment in terms of the threefold way of ethics, meditation, and wisdom, sila, samadhi, prajna. Again and again, in those final months, the Buddha taught this threefold way, and we can see it as a sort of synthesis of all those years of teaching. You know, it's like he was seeing this progressive path of the threefold way as somehow the synthesis of the teachings that he presented to his disciples in this last tour. And ethics here is clearly the foundation of the whole path. The foundation, not in the sense of a preliminary practice to be done before getting on with the real work of the spiritual life. And yeah, just to understand this sense of ethics as a foundation, I like to use the analogy of a pyramid. So when we build a pyramid, the base must keep expanding as the peak of the pyramid grows higher. If the base is too narrow, it's just easily toppled over. So, you know, it's possible to have glimpses of the way things are. But if our being is too narrow, we're just not going to be able to hold and absorb and assimilate those insights. I found very telling a story I read about Alexander, the founder of the Alexander technique, which is a body technique. And Alexander was an actor who at one point lost his voice, and just through working with mirrors and his body, actually managed to recover his voice. And I think he was a sort of intuitive genius. And he used to be able to work with people, just touching and guiding their bodies to help them release deep held tensions. And he once worked with somebody who, I think even since childhood, had been in a very tight, distorted, physically knocked up, a knotted up bodily state. And he spent some hours working with this person, just gently guiding their body to the point where they were, their posture was upright, open, and just for a short while they experienced an emotional freedom and freedom of movement in their body. But actually the underlying patterning of their psyche, the underlying mental tendencies hadn't really been touched. And over the next day or two, this person just locked back into the physical and emotional knot they'd been in previously. So they'd been able to, through this sort of external intervention, if you like, of this intuitive genius, they'd actually touched a certain freedom, but the underlying patterning of their being hadn't been touched. And so they were soon locked back in their old ways and habits. So through ethics, we can begin to realign our being with the way things are in a very immediate and practical way. We can begin to move away from a self-centered mode that's expressed in craving and in will, ill will, towards a sense of connectedness with life, with the people around us, with a deepening empathy, kindness, generosity, and understanding. And this then allows for a more expansive states of mind in meditation and in a deeper reflection and sustained reflection on the true nature of things. So it's important when we in all this to recognize wisdom isn't something we get. Wisdom, you could say, ultimately is an alignment of our whole being at a profound level with the way things really are. You know, the Yogacara talks about a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. So the preliminary work of this realignment of our being is done at the level of ethics. You're just becoming less selfish. It's no good talking about shunyata and emptiness and no self if we remain selfish, if we remain self-centered in all the details of our everyday life. in all the relationships and encounters of our everyday life. We need to be working in all those little situations to bring about this basic realignment of ourselves. So that when we do have little insights, glimpses of things, momentary alignments, if you like, with the true nature of things, well, we can actually get hold of them. We can consolidate them. They don't just slip away. And this is brought out in the structure of the 10 precepts themselves. They're divided into three groups of body, speech, and mind. So the body precepts, we avoid actions that kill, harm living beings. We cultivate deeds of loving kindness. We avoid taking the not given and develop open-handed generosity. We avoid sexual misconduct and develop stillness, simplicity, and contentment. Then on the level of speech, we avoid false speech and cultivate truthful communication. We avoid harsh speech, develop kindly speech. We avoid slanderous speech, develop harmonizing speech. We avoid useless speech, develop helpful speech. And then finally, the level of mind, working on the mind, with the mind. We avoid covetousness and craving and develop tranquility. We avoid hatred and ill will and develop compassion. We avoid false views and ignorance and cultivate wisdom. So we can say, and the Buddhism very clearly says, in the end it all comes down to mind. Mind is the root of it all. Again, we have the first verses of the Dhammapada. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. But there's no chance of working directly on the mind, with the mind, if we're not able to work first on the levels of body and speech, where there's an objective reference, a mirror out there in the world. We and others see our actions, hear our speech. You know, we get an immediate feedback as to what we're saying and doing. But mind is much more tricky and elusive. So we start to train our mind, actually in a very immediate way, in reference to bodily action and speech. And in this way we gradually get to grips with the mind, so we're able to take our ethical practice to more and more subtle and essential levels, where we can work directly on the mind, with the mind. So we can easily see ethics, sila, very much in terms of our own personal practice, even though it relates very much to our behaviour in regard to other people, and even though, as a paramita, it's part of our own our bodhisattva training. You know, it's very easy just to somehow, my ethics, my actions, my speech, my thoughts. Asanga, in his Bodhisattva Bhumi, in the chapter on ethics, brings out a much more profound understanding, or points out a much more profound understanding of the Bodhisattva's practice of ethics. He says it has to go beyond being just a personal practice, just to do with our own mental states and our own path to insight. He points out that the Bodhisattva's practice of ethics is very much to do with other people. So there's a whole other level of practice, he points out to. We have to not just look at the effect on our own states of mind, but the effect our actions of body, speech and mind have on others. And most importantly, the effect they have on them with regard to encouraging and supporting or discouraging their own movement towards greater love and wisdom, towards enlightenment, towards engagement with the Dharma. And this doesn't just mean encouraging or discouraging them to be Buddhists in a quite literal way. It really means our own example in every aspect of our life, down to the smallest deeds of considerateness, friendliness, and the effect those might have in encouraging others to live more skillfully. So when we start to think of ethics in this way, we can begin to understand that ethics, especially as a paramita practiced by the Bodhisattva, far from being a preliminary practice, taken on fully, becomes even a path to wisdom. So there you have the first two paramitas.